David Ben-Gurion was in fact a radical Marxist. He was part of a group called Paul Zion. Paul Zion was instrumental in the communist revolution in Russia. And when he was younger, he used to actually frequently rob wealthier citizens. Then he immigrated in the wake of the pogroms. He immigrated to Palestine. And he was instrumental in something called Hebrew labor. And he was also a proponent of segregation, of segregating Arabs and Jews, which eventually this gradually started to manifest. Hebrew labor, for those who don't understand, what that is specifically is the concept that you only employ Jews. You do right. not employ Arabs. There were these underhanded land purchases taking place. And then once this large land was purchased, all of the Palestinians that worked it, what they actually had back then was more communally owned lands. So these people for generations had been working this land where I live now, but eventually some slick politicians are going to come here, and with the whisk of a pen, they're going to be able to get a hold of that land. Really what happened in Palestine in many ways that people don't recognize, it wasn't about Jews and Muslims. That was nowhere near the reality of what was really going on. The bigger thing was a clash of civilizations, where you had this Western imperialism, and it knew the assignment from the beginning, which was economical conquest, which was subjugation, and the Palestinian population was not at all prepared.
Welcome to Far Out with Faust, everybody. I am Faust Ticho, and today I am excited and delighted to be joined by my brother from another mother once again, Gavin Nascimento. He is an intelligence analyst like no other, a conspiracy realist. He is known and renowned for his incredible attention to detail and adherence to facts, and he is a meticulous researcher and analyst. Okay. He doesn't deal in theories. He sticks to what he can prove with evidence, and his reputation reflects that. And the people who follow him know that and count on him. And I encourage you, if you are not following him across his social media presence and platforms, you should. He will help keep you informed. So, Gavin, my brother, welcome back. It is a pleasure to have you on the show. Let's catch up, my man.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the very kind introduction, and looking forward to this, man. It is going to be a hell of a roller coaster, and I'll do my best to steer the wheel as effectively as I can.
I'll try to help navigate, my man. You know, there's just so much going on. You know, it's a shitstorm, and it's just terrible what's going on. It's terrible the amount of casualties that we're up to. It's terrible that there is an embargo on an entire swath of over a million people who are literally starving, and that the world is, I shouldn't say the world, because a lot of the world is waking up. A lot of Americans are still justifying what's happening. And that is the sense I get on social media. The majority of people are still, and it could be the base that I've built on IG that tends to fall into this category. Yeah, look,
I think what's really tricky about all of this, right, is within our field, within the dimension that we work, is some very influential, otherwise sensible individuals that generally are a voice of reason and rationality that are fucking bizarrely and almost blindly siding with Israel, such as, let's say, for example, Jordan Peterson or Ben Shapiro. Yeah. Now, these are otherwise very sensible critical thinkers, but the reality for somebody who's really dug deeply into this, and I've listened to the videos from both Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro, the fact of the matter is, and I'm just going to be call a spade, I admire their work, especially Jordan Peterson. Although I'm very disappointed in both of their presentations and recently, I can tell you, though, listening to both of them, they have no idea what the fuck they're talking about. That's the reality. Yeah, I can say that with confidence. Like, since the last interviews we did several months ago, I've taken a quantum leap then in my awareness of precisely what's going on there, the history and so on and so forth. And so when I listen to them speak now, I don't necessarily believe, in fact, I'm quite confident that it's not intentional malevolence or insidiousness on their part. I think it's unconscious tribalism. And it's just once again a testament to the fact that irrespective of how intelligent somebody is, because they both are extremely intelligent people, irrespective of that, you can still succumb to the trappings of tribalism. So we need to be mindful of that at all times.
Absolutely. And I just have to point this out because the other thing I see that creates, let's just call it a blind spot in many people, intelligent people, is the religious underpinning of and the tribalism and that mentality that it creates, because
100%.
It is very difficult to overcome, you know, what I would, you know, that kind of belief system once it's ingrained. And I think that's very apparent. All you have to do is listen to Ben Shapiro's idea and quote knowledge that he spews about Israel, you know, and you're just, I'm just like, and people think that this, you know, it is painful. Now, and you know, people are like, well, he's really, really smart. I'm like, yeah, he's smart as a whip, but he is misinformed about a great many things.
At the end of the day, that cat is, he's book smart. And the thing about books is unless you've read all of them, which nobody has, you're going to have a very limited worldview. You're going to have a keyhole worldview. And I can tell you that what he echoes, that's why I don't think it's intentional malevolence or insidiousness. What he echoes is generally the kind of propaganda that gets fed to the average Jewish person or even the Jewish academic. Like I listened to his so-called, you know, he had a recent thing on his YouTube channel. It's called Facts, and he talks about what's really going on in Palestine. It's mind-blowing.
Facts.
And then I watched a longer one that he did 2 years ago, like an hour long. I watched both of them on several occasions, paused, stopped. It was very painful to listen to. But he omits such remarkably incriminating information that, again, I don't think it's intentional insidiousness. If it is, that's problematic big time. But I don't think it is. I think it's just that he has massive blind spots. However, in the midst of what's taking place now, where there is this convergence of information, there's no excuse not for him to look into the other side of this debate, because it's insurmountable. You know, it's almost like the debate between the analogy I used in the past when people were propounding the lockdowns. What I compared that to was the theoretical evidence justifying lockdowns was like an anthill made out of sand, whereas the peer-reviewed credentialed science spanning decades showing how dangerous and deadly lockdowns were is like a mountain. You cannot compare the two. And that's where we are. When you really dig into things, that's what you become faced with historically and in the modern context in relation to Palestine and Israel.
Yeah. And unfortunately, this general knowledge, you know, I mean, academia is controlled by the money, and Ben Shapiro has, you know, all kinds of credits to his name, all in the, you know, based in the academic world, and his views reflect that unfortunate bias. But let's get into it, my man. Let's get into, because there is a hidden history here that most people
I would say 95% of it is hidden history. Really?
Very well hidden and methodically left out of the history books, you know. And there's this great big veil that's been pulled over this planet about God's chosen land, right? And this notion that, look, I was born and raised Catholic. So I understand that Israel has had an important role, but we are muddying the waters here, you know. I mean, we're talking about a nation funded and started by the Rothschild banking dynasty, you know, and it's amazing to me that Christians continue to go to bat and justify and defend genocide on this scale, because they imagine that this is somehow biblically you know,
in depth. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, it's
crazy.
Let's get it's into wild. It. Because this is, like you said, there's a disturbing ideology that has roots in some of the most dangerous isms that are out there.
It's profoundly. So the state of Israel itself is the total inversion of what we have been told to believe it is, which is this religiously favored, divine kind of sanctioned state. The fact of the matter is the founding fathers of the state of Israel were radical Marxists, and also they were compared, of course today it's like blasphemy, but radical fascists. That's the reality. If you look at the actual history, which hopefully we'll get to detail that, that's what we're dealing with. And these were non-religious Jews. And then in relation to the Christian Zionist ideology behind it, the first proponents of settling, resettling Jews in Palestine, in the area that we now call Israel, was in fact Christian Zionists from the British Empire, but it was for geostrategic reasons. And we'll get into that also in a moment. But just very quickly, there's a lot of things. So anybody that is listening to this, I highly encourage them to listen to the other two podcasts that we did as well. Because one of the fundamentals that we, I think was actually in the first podcast that we touched on, sorry, I'm in the woods and there's insects crawling on me and stuff. One of the first things we touched on was what is certainly to me the foundation that needs to be addressed first and foremost. You have to go right to the root of the issue. And this is this alleged divine covenant with the patriarch of the Abrahamic religions. Now, just very quickly, because I'm going to refer to people to their podcast, I don't want to reinvent the wheel like we went through that. But the patriarch was a guy by the name of Abraham. Okay, Abraham was born in Mesopotamia, boys and girls, which is Iraq. He didn't even come from Palestine. He didn't even come from that region. The author then claims that God is promising this land to you. Okay, now, when I say the author, some people will say Moses, but the reality is it's a point of contention because you cannot author your own death, which is what happens in the first five books. Okay?
Right.
Now, Moses, allegedly Moses, or the author of the publication, he claims, oh, you know, God said that he promises you this land. That sounds fantastic, right? Gonna go there. This almost is the myth before the myth about a land without people for a people without land. That kind of shit, right?
Yeah.
Well, eventually, as the story progresses, it degenerates into a literal act of genocide. So at first, it's about giving the land. And then as they get closer and closer, well, the author starts saying, look, man, you're going to have to go into this land and you are going to have to kill every man, every woman, every child that even literally says infant. And they even talk about killing all the cattle. Don't leave anything alive breathing. And I encourage
anybody. Where does it say that again?
Let me, you know what, I've got that in the original slides. So just give me a moment, Charles.
Okay.
Again, people can refer to the first one that we did, but I've got it just somewhere. Just bear with me for a moment.
While you look for that, let me just say this.
Yeah.
Any book that says that God said to kill is a book that you should throw out. Not a book you should believe in, because I'll tell you right now, God would never say that, all right? God loves all his creatures.
My thoughts exactly. Let me touch on that in a moment. Okay, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to just tell people to refer to the first podcast because I did cite it. I gave the sources and the citations.
Right.
I don't want to get hung up in it. But in relation to what you're saying specifically, right? Let's just assess the logic. First of all, the moment this violates the golden rule, this violates one of the basic tenets of every Abrahamic religion and even that which precedes and transcends religion, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The moment you hear somebody say that babies deserve to be killed because they are innately evil, the difference between that being recognized as so-called Israelite ideology or Nazi ideology is public relations. It's propaganda, guys. And if you cannot think critically with the internal makeup and intelligence that has been inculcated in you naturally, which cannot be edited by propagandists, then what you need to recognize is that's the place you have to look at first, the proverbial kingdom within. And I mean, this is all stuff that we touched on. And then just to complement that quickly, specifically for Christian Zionists, right? Because they believe in the New Testament. This was written in the Old Testament, or the Tanakh, or the Torah, okay? In the so-called, in the New Testament, then God has a totally different attitude. Like, you know, you must love thy neighbor and, you know, you turn the other cheek and so on. Now, as it says in the Bible, a thousand years is like a day to God. So if God changes his mind from the Old Testament to the New Testament, that's like being bipolar, because it's changing your attitude totally from one day to the next. It's just, it's silly, okay? It's very, very silly. So that's the first point of contention that needs to be aggressively addressed, because it's ridiculous. It's no different than Nazi propaganda, guys. And if you can't deduce something so obvious, then you need to recognize, you know, there was a guy by the name of Ernest Holmes, and he had a totally different interpretation of the Bible. Very interesting to check out. But he had a great quote where he said that we are bound by nothing except belief. We are bound by nothing except belief, which coincides with, you know, when Bob Marley was paraphrasing Marcus Garvey, and he said, emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves free our minds. And part of really emancipating yourself mentally, because that's the first step to any kind of freedom, right? Without mental freedom, there is no such thing as freedom. We have to be willing to challenge our core beliefs as potentially being wrong, and as being potentially inserted there by deceptive and shadowy forces. Because if you look around, boys and girls, the world in which we live, it's the agents of deception that are in power. And that which is popular, that which is most easily found, such as the most popular book in the world, the Bible, which, you know, this was tabulated, like I explained in the previous podcast, by the Roman Empire under Constantine the Great, who killed his own son and he killed his own wife and he practiced all these pagan things. I mean, so much of Christianity today is really just paganism dressed up as Christianity. But we have to question, like, could the whole story that we've been told, and I know this is very daunting, especially for people that have built the foundation of the identity on these things, because then it puts you in a position where you feel lost. And I get that. I'm not trying to strip that away from you. I'm not trying to take it away from you. I'm not trying to throw out the baby with the proverbial bathwater, right? Yeah. I'm not trying to do that. You can still maintain the greater tenets that assimilate and that resonate with you morally, without,
that's right,
you know, without succumbing to something that is obviously so depraved and so irrational and so inhumane.
Yeah, and liberation is the key word. You know, I mean, it's really hard for me to subscribe and put any kind of stock, because I don't see. I just see religion being part of the problem in this world. There's been very little benefit from this. You know, I always like to, you know, I like to kind of go far out with my perspective, Gavin. I think about it, and you know, when I kind of intuitively feel into this notion of religion, I feel like it is an Earth problem. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like if you went to another planet where there was humanoids like us and they were doing their thing, and you were like, so what's your guy's religion? They'd be like, what's a religion? Like, well, don't you, what is, well, like, look, your concept of God, you know? And they would be like, you mean like the creator that made us and is us? I feel like it would be like, they would be confused. And like, so I'm going to get into a fight with you because you have a different idea of who and what the creator is. I'd like, it would be a crazy concept. I don't know. It's just a thought I often have.
Look, a very simple analogy that I thought about one day. I was sitting there and I thought, you know, what's a good way to contextualize this that people can understand in a short and concise manner? The way I would describe it is, it's similar to Plato's allegory of the cave, but different. And what I mean by that is, imagine that you are in a dungeon. It's dark. You cannot see anything. And then you see a little candlelight. And so naturally you gravitate towards this candlelight because it allows you to see a bit more of what's going on in this dungeon.
Yeah.
But now if you don't use that candlelight to guide you to a greater form of light, to guide you out of the dungeon, no matter what. Yes, you've got a little light now, but you're still stuck in the dungeon. To me, that's analogous to religion. So yeah. Oftentimes people will be in such blinding darkness. And this, you know, for anybody that's been to jail, you know that people are intensely religious there, and it actually gives them some kind of solace. Because they're in such a dark place that they need something, right? The storm is raging. You need to hold on to something, even now with this woke ideology and all this crazy shit. For a lot of people, that's the only form of candlelight they have in the darkness. And so they cling to this. Yeah. However, people need not confuse the small candlelight with something far brighter that illuminates on a much greater level. And that's also in relation to the concept of enlightenment. But the tricky part is enlightenment is an eternal journey, right? To come into alignment with the truth, which represents all the knowledge that we have gained as a total society throughout so-called civilization, including the knowledge that has been suppressed, and then all the knowledge we still have to gain. So in other words, it's potentially infinite. We don't even know how far it goes. It's like the ocean. Yeah. Nobody's been to the bottom of the ocean. So whoever is listening to this, I'm a proponent of people abiding by religion if it affords them the opportunity as a stepping stone to continue their personal growth in this world and be a better human being.
Yeah.
But as the saying goes, if you need religion to engage in kindness, if you need some kind of motive, like, oh, I'm going to get to heaven if I do good things, the problem is that you're a bit of a shitty person. Like, you, not just, you know, people I don't believe are innately shitty people,
but
you need to get in touch with who you are on a deeper level, man, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't want to snatch that away from people. Like, we're living in crazy times, you know, where people are fucking just saturated.
People are like, repent, Jesus is coming. I'm like,
Yeah, no, that's when it starts to get excessive.
Listen,
that right there has been an endless theme throughout history, and it's always been capitalized upon by the parasite class. You know,
repent, Jesus. I can't wait for Jesus to come. I'm like, I think Jesus was already here. I mean, I hope you're right. I hope he does come, but I wouldn't like skip lunch and wait for him. I would just kind of carry on with what you're doing.
For me, it's like this, man. Let's say that is something that's going to really happen. Why not just do the best you can so that either way you're doing the best that you can? You know what I mean? It's just, it's a very strange thing to me, like to wait around. I mean, there's also a proverb, if I recall correctly, in the Bible, about waiting around is something that's frowned upon by Jesus and by the the prophets. It's,
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm crazy, but it's just so fucking immature to me. It's such a foolhardy notion. This notion of it's so and like, this is a problem. Like, I think that we need to spiritually evolve as a people and understand that punishment doesn't come in the afterlife, and in a very real way, it doesn't serve us in this life. There are consequences to actions, and those consequences can sometimes feel like punishments. And
yeah, and if you're living unconsciously,
and people will suffer from them. But like this notion that, you know, they're going to burn in hell, and dude, you know what I mean? Like that's not helping anything. You know, I understand the sentiment, 100%. And I do feel like there are people, you know,
stuff like that can't even be answered, man. You know what I mean? Like,
we
don't know. So for me, it's very simple, right? Like, this is kind of the debate between choice and fate. Like, are you guiding your life through choice, or is there fate? I think that it could potentially be a bit of both. However, because the only thing within my control is my decisions, I need to take ownership of that fully and wholly. And I need to assume, for the purpose of being as productive as I possibly can, that is really the primary influence, not just in my personal life, but in society at large. And so that not only results in personal subjective responsibility, but in a responsibility of how you imprint on this world, on this reality, on this planet, and so on. And then also collectively. Yeah.
And this is what blows me away, Kat. People are like, every baby killed, every Palestine baby killed is Hamas's fault. Every person who died, and I even saw this quote saying that we'll never forgive them. It was from an Israeli official. We'll never forgive them for making us kill their babies. I mean, this was a quote.
Oh, goodness.
And I'm just like, do you hear yourselves?
Yeah.
This thinking is insane. You know,
it's completely insane. But it also appeals to people who, unfortunately, are blinded by the darkness of ignorance, which is to say they don't recognize and understand that there's a level of sophistication in warfare today where you can target a specific individual with such precision. And I'm not even talking about through conventional tactics. You can even do it biologically, where you can wipe out people specifically, and I can guarantee you they'll easily get biological profiles on this. It's nonsense. Because
it's total
you know what we should do? We should climb into this, man, because then I can actually illuminate the ideology behind why the state of Israel acts like that. And then once we get into that, people are gonna have an aha moment and they're gonna say, well, there you go. They've had a policy since the earliest immigrants landed there, the earliest radical immigrants landed there from the Russian Empire, that they were gonna take the land by force. And they've had this idea of, today it's commonly called Greater Israel, but it's actually rooted in something called revisionist Zionism, which is land maximalism, right? They want to have a very large tract of land. And so what you're seeing is the natural result of that, because the ethos of the current Likud party is dominated by revisionist Zionism. So when people get that, they're going to realize, okay, this isn't about the religion of biblical accounts. This is actually about the religion of ideology, the religion of revisionist Zionism specifically. So we'll get into all of this, man. And there's a diversity of influences involved here that actually ties into the much larger construct of global governance. This isn't just about the state of Israel. This is about global governance.
I mean, for those of us who have an understanding of this blueprint and this signature, this is very apparent. You know, watching events, this screams of global governance, and this screams of this agenda that is happening and why this war popped off. And
wait till we get into things, guys, and it's gonna become very, very clear how this is Israel. The state of Israel is simply an instrumental weapon in the bag of tricks of the parasite class on the global level.
Yeah. So take us into the weeds, brother. Let's track this for us. You know, where should we 100%. Start?
Because what we'll do is we'll actually start with British Christian Zionism. Okay, so Lord Shaftesbury, he was one of the first that put forward the idea of resettling the Jews in, at the time, what was it, the Turkish Empire. And as you can see here, he outlined this in the Quarterly Review. It was written in 1839, so this was a long time ago. And I looked up this specific publication, which is why I put over there page 105. For anybody that wants to fact check, even though this is a credentialed historian, I like to still fact check things. It's good to do that. And so you can see over here, he spoke about the growth of the produce, so the food over there. He spoke about the finest cotton may be obtained in almost unlimited abundance, silk and madder and olive oil. And so he said that this would be a good place geostrategically. And the significance for mentioning this is that, yeah, we have already in the early 1800s, a Christian Zionist, a politician, who's talking about resettling the Jews in a specific piece of land, and really using them more so as kind of a buffer, just kind of as a tributary, as a vassal state. And this guy, what also makes him so significant, for those who have heard about this quote, a land with people, for a people without land, which is one of the mythologies. It's never been true, but it sounds really cool. He was the one that actually invented that. So he was the originator of that.
This guy did that? Wow.
Yeah, Lord Shaftesbury. Okay, then yeah. a second dude, and this was at the same time as this guy, around the same time. This guy over here, Charles Henry Churchill. He was actually Winston Churchill's ancestor. The Churchill family is actually very prominent in Britain, which I didn't know about this until recently, but the Churchill family has been very prominent historically. It's one of the powerful families there. And so he came up with an idea for a plan to create a Zionist state in the region of Palestine. And he specifically did this, again, for geostrategic reasons. So if you look at this publication he wrote, it's called Mount Lebanon. And this was, again, during the 1800s, the mid-1800s. Mm. And you see in the bottom over there, this is in the preface, he says, "It must, for obvious reasons, be clear to every English mind that if England's Oriental supremacy is to be upheld, Syria and Egypt must be made to fall more or less under her sway of influence." Now, the significance here is, in the past, Palestine was part of Syria. So he's talking about the region of Palestine as well. Mm-hmm. So that's very significant, right? Once again, he's talking about geopolitics. And a good summary of this was put together in a publication called Imperial Perceptions of Palestine. This is page 189. And this was written by Professor Lorenzo Camille. It's always good to know your sources. I like to compare sources in relation to where you're getting your knowledge, your information, and your facts from, in the same way that it's relevant and pertinent to where are you getting your food from. Are you getting organic, good produce? Are you getting it from a local farmer? Is it processed? Is it bullshit? So you need to know your sources. And Professor Lorenzo Camille, he's recognized internationally as a credential authority. He's award-winning and so on. So it's a safe source, is what I'm saying, to cite. Not a controversial guy. And he makes a nice little summary here. So first, he mentions what I pointed out there from the publication Mount Lebanon. And then he says, Churchill identified two conditions for the success of that plan. One is that Jews had to lead the project. So this gives a good cover, is what I'm trying to say. Okay.
Two European powers had to back it.
And two European powers had to back it. Okay. And then part of it, he also started to correspond, you see, 18th June 1841, with a guy by the name of Sir Moses Montefiore. And part of that correspondence, he says at the very end, you can see we have highlighted it, that Syria and Palestine, in a word, must be taken under European protection. So this is Sir Moses Montefiore, very, very influential Jewish figure, and somebody I just recently actually became aware of as being the founder of the first settlement, the first Jewish settlement. So Rishon LeZion, which we covered in the previous interview, that is recognized officially as being the first settlement founded by the Jews, and this was by Baron Edmund de Rothschild through his patronage. But what isn't spoken about is the fact that prior to him, there was actually this guy, Sir Moses Montefiore, and he found this settlement over here. And the interesting thing about this is, look at the date, 1860. So this happened after the correspondence he had with Churchill, right, with Charles Henry Churchill. That's very significant. So he had the correspondence. You can see over here, this was 1841. They started talking about it. And then by 1860, eventually, after pouring some cash into there, after working the plans out, obviously, they founded the first colony. So
let me ask you a question, Gavin.
I'm going to stop sharing here. Let me get out of here real quick. Okay.
So let me just ask you this. Where was Israel, the place, in the year 1800?
No, it was obviously non-existent.
It wasn't existence, right? Where was Israel in 1500?
Yeah, it did not exist, 100%.
It didn't exist, right? What about the year 1000?
Yeah, still nada, brother.
So how the fuck? I don't understand how people... I mean, I see this, all people are like... People believe that Palestine never existed. And I'm like, what are you, what, like, I don't even know what to say to these people. They're so confused.
So I have heard this argument, and what I would say to that, it's very easy to dismiss for somebody who has some insight, is every single country that you recognize today, the borders, the names, even nationalities, none of that existed. These are all constructs that were created at one time or another. So right. this argument is superfluous. It amounts to nothing. It's like saying, yeah. Oh, Europe never existed.
Right.
Earth never existed. You're right. Earth didn't exist because it didn't have a name. It wasn't recognized by a name. Palestinian, that region historically, yes, it's existed. And the people that were there, and we're going to get into this. I mean, we're going to go into information because these are more surface level debates. We're going to go into shit much deeper. But Palestine and the people there, the ultimate significance is that the people that were there had been there for centuries. Okay. Tilling the land. They had very different land laws, which we can get into as well. And unlike the propaganda we've been told, where, oh, these innocent Jews that were being oppressed, and there was certainly an element of that, but the most influential were radical, and some of them were literally terrorists. And from the beginning, from the moment they landed there, it was very unambiguous, where they made it resoundingly clear that their plan was to go ahead, and at this time, they were a small minority, less than 10% of the population, that they were going to become the majority. They were going to get rid of the Arab majority. They make this very clear. We're going to get into the details. I'm going to show the publications that they're going to get rid of this Arab majority, and they are going to likely have to do so through force. So what's going to happen there? Imagine specifically because one of the strongest demographics that support this as a result of being indoctrinated, which is in the United States. Imagine now you have Chinese and Russian billionaires that show up in the United States and they start writing openly, their intellectuals start writing openly about how they are going to oust the majority American population with the Chinese, exactly, with the Chinese and Russian population. How would people feel about that? They wouldn't feel very good. They would eventually take up armed resistance. And that's just, of course, a very oversimplified version. There's a lot more in it. And it all starts to make sense when you actually have the details before you. And we'll get into that.
Yeah. So where were we? Let's proceed.
Okay.
We were...
All right, 100%. Let me just see if I can get this right
Churchill,
again.
Yeah.
Okay, just give me a moment, your entire screen.
Because people don't understand that there is a through line. There's a genealogy, for lack of a better word. You know, there's a lineage, a family tree, you know, a relationship between eugenics, Nazism,
all of it coincides.
And Zionism.
We're going to go through all of that shit, man. All of it is going to converge in such a profound way that people who have been interested in this topic are going to just, for me as a researcher, it's been one of the most interesting things I have ever researched, probably also because I have the vantage point of having quite a strong understanding of the history of global governance. And now for me to see how the state of Israel fits into that equation and the relationship with the Nazis and how it has served for geopolitical purposes, all of that coming full circle, man. It is so, so fascinating. But let's move forward and we'll get into it, man, because there's so much to get into. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it all in this podcast. I'm actually going to probably end up teaching. Let me just say I am. I'm going to teach a masterclass on this and how it relates to global government and shadow government at large. Yeah. Okay.
So, nice, bro.
Yeah, man. It has to be done. You know, we're at a point now in history. Okay. So, there's Sir Moses Montefiore. That's where we were lost. Now, Sir Moses Montefiore was related to none other than Nathan Mayer Rothschild. He was his brother-in-law. They both married into another prominent Jewish family called the Cohen family. Now, the significance of Nathan Mayer Rothschild. Now, this dude was the big boy. He was one of the five sons of Mayer Amschel Rothschild. But he was really... in many ways, you can consider him to be the head honcho dude, right? He was under his patronage. As you can see, I got this. This is directly from the Rothschilds archive. People can go look this up for themselves. Where they rescued the Bank of England. You see, in late 1825, the Rothschilds averted a financial crisis by supplying a large volume of gold to the Bank of England when the bank ran desperately short of coin gold. And then also the Waterloo Commission, which preceded that, for the British government, they helped to basically fund and supply Wellington's army. And they did this on multiple occasions. They also did this in the Crimea War. And then they also did this in World War II. So why am I pointing this out specifically about Nathan Mayer Rothschild? So I'll refer people to the previous podcast we've done where we spoke and we detailed the Rothschilds' influence in the foundation of the State of Israel. But more significantly, because what I'm exploring first before we move forward into the radicalism from in the Russian Empire, the what was the fanatical radicalism that was dominating that population, and then the Jewish immigrants that came out of that and how they brought that ideology with them. The first thing we're actually going to address here is the hidden hand of the British Empire in the establishment of Israel. And the first thing I want to just establish here is how the Rothschild family and the British royals have been partners for literally two centuries. So you cannot speak about one without the other. Their decisions are very closely connected, is my point. So over here, this guy, Baron Lionel de Rothschild. Okay, this was the son of the aforementioned Nathan Mayer Rothschild. And he was the first Jewish member of parliament in the city of London. And this is when the relationship of directly advising the royal family also begins. So you see in 1852, the Rothschild family, under the leadership of Baron Lionel de Rothschild, they advised Queen Victoria and Prince Albert on a number of things, and they, you know, give them loans. I encourage people, go check out the Rothschilds archive. Although, you know, it's really interesting. Remember the first two podcasts we did, and I went through some of the Rothschilds archives info? Yeah. You know that some of that stuff has now been hidden behind a security
paywall.
But anybody that runs into that, but anybody that does run into that, check out archive.org, because it's likely that the pages were archived. And if I visited them, then I probably archived it myself. And then you see over here in 1852, they're advising the Queen and then the Prince. And then also the establishment of the Royal Mint Finery in 1852, which would be serve their war efforts. And this is the big one as it relates to Palestine. And we addressed this again in a previous podcast where they helped them purchase the Suez Canal. And the Suez Canal, just to give a quick summation, so for people that are listening to this for the first time, if you do find this podcast interesting, which I'm sure you will if you go through the whole thing, go to one of the previous ones, because what the Suez Canal represented was a pivotal global route to control trade. In fact, it was the pivotal route. So if you could control that, then you were capable of controlling basically international trade. And that's why the Berlin to Baghdad Railroad, which was being built between the German Empire and the Turkish Empire, that was basically a direct threat to the Suez Canal, and is now recognized and studied by historians as being one of the primary, if not the primary, reason for the First World War. So again, this is just to illustrate the relationship between the Rothschilds and the British royals and how close it was. And this has gone all the way up until the modern day. So we see Evelyn de Rothschild, he recently passed away, and he was a direct advisor to the Queen. And I'm sure this relationship probably still goes on in some kind of capacity, but I haven't, you know, there's so many things going on. But as you can see, for two centuries, literally, the Rothschild family and the royal in the royals in Britain, and actually beyond Britain, the royals all throughout Europe have worked with the Rothschilds on one level or another. And this then takes us to his son. So Baron Lionel de Rothschild's eldest son was this guy over here. His name was also Nathan Mayer Rothschild, but he was the second one, because obviously this one over here was the first one. I know it's a bit confusing, guys, so just stick with me. Don't get too hung up on the names.
It doesn't help that they're all fucking inbred either.
Exactly, 100%, yes. And they literally did. Those dudes married their cousins. And,
say it right, you know. They'll tell you themselves. Yeah. Keep it in family.
So where this gets significant now, right, is Lord Rothschild, that's, we'll refer to him in that context because it's easier to remember. He was connected to this guy, Cecil Rhodes, and Cecil Rhodes was engaged in the British South Africa Company, which colonized South Africa, and actually played a role in apartheid before apartheid existed. It laid down the groundwork for that. People don't know about that. And the De Beers Company, which was also actually instrumental in laying down the blueprint for apartheid. Now, Lord Rothschild helped to finance Cecil Rhodes in these two particular organizations. But more specifically, Cecil Rhodes had this idea, okay, of, and let me stop it, Jan, and we'll go back to it. Let me talk about it first a little bit. Okay, Cecil Rhodes had this idea, right, of literally creating a secret society to further the British establishment's power in a clandestine way. And they wanted to actually reabsorb the United States. And there was a eugenics element behind this, where he wanted to proliferate the Anglo-Saxon race in specific and in particular. Now, bear in mind, this is, I don't know, 67 years, long before Hitler came along. Okay, it's almost like a full century before the Nazi policies are being implemented. And so he had this concept and this idea that he wanted to engage in. And one of the ways he was going to do this, let me go ahead and get that share screen, was through something called the Rhodes Trust. Now, some people may have heard of Rhodes Scholars, right? The prestigious Rhodes Scholarship. That's actually, that comes from Cecil Rhodes and specifically the Rhodes Trust. So you can see at the bottom of here, I have a picture of this very eerie symbolism of this owl that looks like something from Bohemian Grove. Yeah, very interesting. Mm-hmm. They've got very interesting symbols, man, when you start to study them very closely in the esoteric and occult meanings. But this is where things start to get quite interesting. Okay, you start to see a really shadowy influence in all of this. So the Rhodes Trust was established for this purpose. And now just to go with some specific quotes, and anybody can look this up. This is not anything controversial. It is incontrovertible. You can look up his dying wills. Okay. Wow. And Lord Rothschild was actually entrusted as a trustee to execute the Rhodes Scholarship and the Rhodes Trust. That's the significance. Yeah, that's the connection. And you can see over here.
Let me read this. Contend that we are the finest race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race. Just fancy those parts that are at present inhabited by the most despicable specimens of human beings. What an alteration there would be if they were brought under Anglo-Saxon influence. Look again at the extra employment a new country added to our dominion gives. I contend that every acre added to our territory means, in the future, birth to some more of the English race, and then it cuts off a little bit, be brought into existence. So this is...
this is just racism, an excerpt. Oh, yeah. That clearly underscores a major consideration of eugenics. But now look at the second part to this, right? I'm going to let you go ahead and read that as well, just to give a different narration in all of this.
Okay. The idea gleaming and dancing before one's eyes like a will of the wisp at last frames itself into plan. Why should we not form a secret society with but one object, the furtherance of the British Empire and the bringing of the whole uncivilized world under British rule for the recovery of the United States, for the making the Anglo-Saxon race but one empire? What a dream, but yet it is probable, it is possible. There's your plan, ladies and gentlemen.
It's gonna get crazier. It's going to get crazier. So let me just take a moment to pause there and stop. And then we can talk about that a little bit further. Okay.
I mean, you see the foreshadow there of every ethnogenocide that has happened since then. You can look at what they did in Africa. Look at the structures they created. Look at what they've done. How can you not see that Nazi Germany literally took a page from this, you know?
It's definitely all connected, man. But we're going to get into it. We're going to lay down the details because it snowballs from there. So
yeah,
one of the outgrowths of this Rhodes Scholarship was something called the Round Table Movement. Okay, the Round Table Movement was a think tank, and the Round Table Movement part of their task was to carry out kind of Rhodes' ideas, right? And there were several specific individuals that were involved in this. Now, one of the ways we know about this was actually from a guy by the name of Carol Quigley, Professor Carol Quigley, who I'm sure you've heard it at some point.
Yeah.
Almost everybody has, right? Because this dude is such a strong source, because he's so well credentialed, and he's such an upstanding authority that you can turn people towards. But let's go ahead and there it is. So this is his publication, Tragedy and Hope. And just to preface it real quick with the following. For those who aren't familiar with Professor Carol Quigley, the guy taught at Harvard University. He taught at the Ivy League schools. He taught at Georgetown University. And his course was repeatedly mentioned by all of these like elite politicians as being their favorite. He was highly awarded, highly recognized. Bill Clinton, in fact, named him as one of his primary influences. And so he wrote this publication called Tragedy and Hope. And the reason why I mention all of that is so you know that this is an establishment historian. He generally was, was an establishment historian, which is always best if you can use their own sources, right? And yeah, you see on page 950, where he explains that there does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. Then, just to add over here very quickly before we move forward, he explains that I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been very close to it, to many of its instruments. The only thing that he really objected to was that they wanted to keep it secret. He wanted to share this history, not realizing, and maybe this was a tactic of his, I don't know, but this will naturally, you know, cause some kind of public outrage. Now, one of the things that he spoke about is how this group, this is page 144 of Tragedy and Hope, which is a very difficult read for anybody out there that may be interested. It's a difficult read, man. It's like reading the Bible, and I've read the whole Bible on numerous occasions.
Yeah.
Where he writes over here, he says, but there's some really explosive information every now and then, where he explains one of the things that this roundtable group was working on, and remember, the stated goal of Rhodes' will was the extension of the British Empire through a secret society and through covert means. One of the things that they were working on is how they could change the British Empire into the so-called Commonwealth of Nations. Okay, they were instrumental behind this. And you can even see this now if you go look up on Wikipedia, which this shocked me when I looked it up, because in the past it was very difficult, beyond the guidance provided by Professor Carol Quigley, to corroborate this. But you can see in their journal, which it clearly outlines, and you can read the journal as well, which was established in 1910, it was about the Commonwealth of Nations. And it explains here, and this is where it gets very, very interesting, is that the Commonwealth dates back to the first half of the 20th century, with the decolonization of the British Empire through increased self-governance of its territory. So just very quickly to comment on that. What people need to recognize is throughout history, there has been a reciprocal dance, so to speak, between the parasite class and humanity, okay? Between the humans of this planet that simply want to live in freedom and be left the hell alone and have introductory human principles such as just simple decency, and those who mean to exploit and create chaos. So naturally, as things evolve, the parasite class, being as insidious and skillful as they are, they adapt their strategies. So what they are talking about, Jan, is that during that time, there was a massive movement for decolonization where people were agitating for independence. And when one domino falls, boys and girls, dominoes start falling all around the world. And that's exactly what we are even living through today as a result of the information revolution through the internet. Now, as you see, moving forward, He explains that the Commonwealth was originally created as the British Commonwealth of Nations through the Balfour Declaration.
Wow.
Right? Very, very, very interesting, man. Very, very interesting. Okay. Let's stop that there. All right. So let's talk about that a bit, right?
Yeah.
So the Balfour Declaration, we have recognized this as just personifying what took place in Palestine. And again, I'll refer people to kind of get into the weeds of all of that, because, you know, first they promised the land to the Arabs through the McMahon-Hussein correspondence. Then they promised the land to the Then they promised the land to the Zionist Jews through the Balfour Declaration. And so that's where the most visible conflict stems today. And rightfully so, because it was duplicitous. It was very underhanded, right? But what we aren't told about, and I only recently became aware of this, is that the Balfour Declaration wasn't just between Lord Rothschild and Arthur Balfour, which we know about, right? There were two other highly significant authors involved in that, which was a guy by the name of Leo Amery and Alfred Milner. In fact, Leo Amery is now recognized. Him and Alfred Milner are recognized as the true authors behind the Balfour Declaration. What's the significance of this? The significance in all of this, and I'm going to see if I can just pull up Leo Amery's picture to give people a visual. The significance in all of this is Leo Amery and Alfred Milner were both, as well as Lord Rothschild, they were trustees of Cecil Rhodes' will. They were very close to him. In fact, Leo Amery was the longest standing trustee of Rhodes' will that they had. Let me just share a visual. It's always nice to give people visuals because it helps to reinforce in relation to memory what we are dealing with. Right?
Right.
Okay, let's just get this up here. My apologies. Let's go with a window. Can you do that again? Oh, you got too much stuff going on here, brother. Okay, no, there you go. All right, can you see that?
Yes. Okay.
There's a little visual for people. This is Leo Amery over there. All right. Nice to have a visual. Helps to reinforce it in your mind. What is also significant about Leo Amery is Leo Amery helped to establish something called the Jewish Legion. And he did this alongside a guy by the name of Vladimir Zahev Jabotinsky. Okay, let's pull up old Vladimir Zahev Jabotinsky, because this dude is the most commemorated figure in Israeli history. My brother, wait till we get to that, my dude.
My intuition tells me he's a real savage.
You can just see it in this photo. I mean, a photo's worth a thousand words. Oh, he's a character. We're going to get into that. Okay, we are going to get into that. All right. Let me stop this for a moment. Let's talk about this. Okay. So the Roundtable Group, what made them so significant, right, is during this period, they were in process of countering the movement for independence that was going on globally, decolonization globally. So this period, as it starts to progress, it coincides with the agitation for independence in, let's say, Ireland, the agitation for independence in India, and in all kinds of British dominated
Egypt too,
countries.
I think, right? Right.
In the Middle East, it was everywhere. Kevin. Excuse me.
Because Britain had a stronghold on so many places, but once their banks are in place and they got their corporations set up, you know, people are like,
and that's exactly how they
right.
did it, man.
That's all they needed.
So that's exactly, we're going to get into that right there. Boom. What they basically did is, remember, the Roundtable Movement was a think tank. They needed to come up with, how can we control these people and give them the illusion of independence, right? It's kind of like politics. Give the plebs the illusion of choice, but we still going to control shit at the end of the day. Like, Democrat, Republican, left-wing, right-wing, but when it comes to the really serious shit, we are going to agree at the highest levels. And they always want to provide you with the illusion of choice, because they learned a long, long time ago. In fact, if you go back to the ancient Roman Empire, they started doing this way back then already. They learned a long, long time ago that the easiest way to control people is what you need to do is you have to give them the illusion of choice. Sorry, let me just put this a little bit down. All right. Okay. So we'll lead up into this gradually, because it all starts to converge and it all starts to coincide. Okay, it all starts to come together on how these forces have worked together. Now, I just wanted to lay that foundation down that we have this shadowy hand. We have this roundtable group that is working on how can they control different parts of the globe, which is going to also comprise Palestine. How can they control these different parts of the globe?
They wanted the U.S. back, too.
Without being on the surface. Well, take a look at the Pilgrim Society. Take a look at the relationships in World War I and World War II and how the British establishment brought the U.S. in as its pit bull. Right? Mm-hmm. And the Pilgrim Society, again, check that out. Really good. But what's so crazy about this is it goes beyond that, because we can also start to see the overlap in the relationship and the working with Nazi Germany. It's one big club, like George Carlin said, and you ain't in it. All right, it's them against us. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to put that on the shelf for a moment. We're going to come back to it, and we're going to start to get into the radicals that came out of the Russian Empire, which included the guy that I just showed and mentioned, Vladimir Zahev Jabotinsky. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, we aren't told about this, right? We told the kind of account for people that have even been halfway down the rabbit hole. We are told that basically the Jews that immigrated to Palestine, they moved there as a result of vicious pogroms, right? That's what we get told.
Yeah.
And there is truth to this, undeniably. But you know what we are not told about? Is that these pogroms resulted because there was terrorism going on in the Russian Empire. By an organization called Narodnaya Volya. And I'm probably butchering that, but translated into English, it means the people's will. All right, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to share the screen on this one so people can see what I'm talking about. Okay, boom, there you go. Narodnaya Volya, the people's will. And this was a literal terrorist organization. They actually spoke openly about how they utilized terrorism. And they were a split from an earlier organization called Land and Liberty, which you can see over here. When I do that, can you see the highlight?
I can see where you highlighted, but I can't see that. I can't read it. It's too small.
Okay, wait there. I'm making it a bit bigger. There you go. Is that a bit better?
That's a little better. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, there you go. All right. Land and Liberty. Now, the significance of this specifically... And while I'm talking about this, let me go ahead. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing the screen. Is that if you look at the academic publications regarding the specific topic, is some of the executive leadership of these groups. Now, this was a very powerful group, man. I'm busy working on a blog that's also going to tabulate everything for people that maybe, you know, get a bit lost in translation.
Yeah.
This group was behind the assassination of high-ranking political figures. High-ranking political figures. So they were recognized as a very subversive and dangerous force. One of the significant factors in all of this is that a lot of the executive leadership was made up of prominent Jews. Now, it was a diverse organization. The minority was Jews. It wasn't even a majority. But nonetheless, this was on people's radars. And also the Russian Empire previously had been in the Crimea War. In the Crimea War, they were up against the British establishment and other powers, and the Rothschilds financed the British establishment. So likely these things were on their minds. It was also a very popular publication, I can't recall what it was named now, from a Jew that had converted to Christianity, because, you know, this was Russia back then was Christian Orthodox. And so there was a suspicion, you know, oh, the Jews. Like, that's also been a real thing historically, man. Oh, the Jews are going to come get us, you know.
Merchant of Venice.
Shakespeare. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. We spoke about that before. And it's just as ridiculous as the Muslims going to come get us, you know. It's all just tribalistic, stupid bullshit. But nonetheless, within the executive leadership, there existed a strong Jewish presence. Now, I want to make this very clear to everybody to understand. During this period, one of the things that they were deeply concerned about in the Russian Empire is the nihilism. Nihilism is essentially the belief that life has no purpose. It's non-religious. So it's atheistic. This they viewed as a serious threat to the governing structure, which was Orthodox Christianity. And so the Jews then were, this is the ethnic composition of a Jew, right? Which is diversity within the ethnicity of being a Jew as well. There's Sephardic Jews, there's Ashkenazi Jews, and then there's Mizrahi Jews. But there were these nihilistic Jews such as Karl Marx, right? And I mean, he was just somebody, he spoke about the opium of the masses. So the ideology that was and the opium of the masses was religion. And so this ethos, this ideology was dominating the population. And this organization, the People's Will, carried out high-profile assassinations, right? Until eventually, they murdered none other than Tsar Alexander II of Russia. No, and guess what happened after his assassination? So his assassination was in 1881, right? That's when the pogroms came, in the aftermath. So you can click on there, aftermath for Jews. So he was seen as tolerant for Jews, so on and so forth. But pogroms came, and the May Laws, boom. Okay, there you go. And immediately after this, they instituted the May Laws. So his son came into power, Alexander III. He became stringently targeting against the Jews. They absorbed a lot of the blame for his assassination. And what's very interesting is this assassination is recognized as the first suicide bombing attack in history. Now, there were several people involved. Only one of them was a Jew. But nonetheless, because of the executive leadership of this organization, they were recognized as the predominant threat. And so that's when these pogroms began, right? So let me stop it for a moment there. You know, we can discuss that. So as a result of this, Jews began to leave Russia. Now, very interesting, the May Laws, let me also just actually put this here, and I'm sorry if I'm jumping around a bit, but at the time that these anti-Semitic May laws were being put into effect, the French branch of the Rothschild family were in fact giving loans to the Russian Empire. So you can see
over
here. Oh, yeah, 100%, brother.
You might want to notice.
And this is specifically the French branch that were the ones that were instrumental in the founding of Israel.
Yeah.
So Baron Edmund de Rothschild, you see this company here, it's called Benito. Let's see if I can blow this up a little bit. Yeah, Benito. Benito eventually merged with Royal Dutch Shell. Royal Dutch Shell, boys and girls, helped to finance and fund and provide oil to Nazi Germany, which we are eventually going to get into. But despite the May Laws, they went ahead and they gave a massive loan to Tsar Alexander III's regime, which again shows they don't give a shit, guys. Okay,
no,
they
just don't. It's a create debt, take control of the assets. You know, I mean, the more people in debt, the more people you own. It doesn't matter what side they're fucking on.
Yeah, 100%.
That's what the Rothschilds do best.
They don't have an allegiance to that. What's interesting, though, and I mean, the early stages of contemplating and cogently comprehending this, but Cecil Rhodes, entrusting, who he clearly was, you know, he had these virulently racist views about spreading the Anglo-Saxon influence.
Talk about
worldwide.
Fucking white supremacy. There's your fucking granddaddy right there.
But again, it's important to recognize that he's specifically talking about Anglo-Saxons, right?
Yeah.
And the purity of Anglo-Saxons. But then he's having Lord Rothschild be, who is a Jew, being his trustee. So there seems to be this almost strange notion, and it's just a possibility that the allegiance for Lord Rothschild and others actually first and foremost is Anglo in its origins rather than Jewish.
Yeah.
Right? And I still subscribe to the belief that at the highest levels, man, because Cecil Rhodes, I don't think he was one of the top dudes either. I think at the highest levels, they don't give a shit about any of that stuff.
They don't give a shit.
No.
You think they're fucking wearing yarmulkes and going to synagogue? Are you kidding me?
100%, man. Yeah, and remember, the House of Windsor used to be the House of Saxe, Coburg, and Gotha.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
They're so shifty. They just do whatever is going to get them to rule over people. Yeah.
And they use religion. They use this, especially a religion that composes both an ethnicity and a religion. Boy, that's convenient. You know, that's two shields.
100%, man. It just muddies the water. All right, so now what I want to do is we're going to get into some of the actual founding fathers of Israel. All right, like this is where we can start to expand on why is this state so fucking crazy?
Yeah, because why do they have a proclivity for genocide? Yeah.
Like, I mean, just anybody that has really studied and looked into the policies beyond the theatrics of this regime, why are they like that?
Okay. Yeah.
So let's start with David Ben-Gurion, who is considered the primary founder of Israel. David Ben-Gurion was, in fact, a radical Marxist. He was part of a group called Pol Zion. Pol Zion was instrumental in the communist revolution in Russia. And when he was younger, he used to actually frequently rob wealthier citizens. Then he immigrated in the wake of the pogroms. He immigrated to Palestine. And he was instrumental in something called Hebrew labor. And he was also a proponent of segregation, of segregating Arabs and Jews, which eventually this gradually started to manifest. Hebrew labor, for those who don't understand, what that is specifically is the concept that you only employ Jews. You do not employ Arabs. So one of the great points of contention that later came up with all these white papers and the advocacy for restricting Jewish immigration was that there were these underhanded land purchases taking place. And then once this large land was purchased, all of the Palestinians that worked it, and we can get into like how the land ownership would work, because it's not the concept of ownership we have today in Western society is a very new construct in the human story. What they actually had back then was more communally owned lands. So these people for generations had been working this land. Where I live now, which is, I mean, I'm high up in the mountains, very remote in the Philippines, I get a first hand account of this, because that's kind of how this culture operates. They just, you know, you've got this land, I've got that land, and it's been around for generations. But eventually some slick politicians are going to come here, and with the whisk of a pen, they're going to be able to get a hold of that land. Unless this really what happened in Palestine in many ways that people don't recognize, it wasn't about Jews and Muslims. That was nowhere near the reality of what was really going on. The bigger thing was a clash of civilizations, where you had this Western imperialism, and it knew the assignment from the beginning, which was economical conquest, which was subjugation, and the Palestinian population was not at all prepared. And unfortunately, the leaders sold them out. Okay, so David Ben-Gurion is one of the elements, and he's a guy that founded something called labor Zionism. The reality is labor Zionism was radical Marxism, okay? Except Marxism is about class conflict. They adopted the ideals of also having a Jewish supremacy view, right? And he became the primary founder of Israel. He was the first prime minister. Another guy was named Meir Dizenhof. Meir Dizenhof was, in fact, a member of that terrorist group that I just mentioned, the People's Will. He was sent after he went to prison for several months as a result of him being a part of that group. He was then actually sent to Palestine on the patronage of Baron Edmund de Rothschild, which is interesting. So you see the Rothschild hand here again. And this guy eventually became the first mayor of Tel Aviv. So we have a guy that was literally involved with the terrorist organization. He's the first mayor of Tel Aviv. And when the Israeli Declaration of Independence was signed, it was signed at his home by Ben-Gurion. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. Another guy, and I suppose let me just see if I can bring up some visuals. Yeah. Mayor.
Say what you want about America, but our founding fathers weren't fucking terrorists.
These dudes were straight up something else.
They
were
fucking killers, you know.
It's wild, man. I mean, people can easily look up who David Ben-Gurion is. He's one of the most famous figures involved. So I suppose I don't have to.
Show people specifically who he is. A phone can look him up.
Yeah, 100%. But Meir Dizenhof, I can show people who that is, because obviously even the way I'm pronouncing it, if somebody wants to search the name, they're going to be like, what the hell is this dude saying?
I'll spell it for everyone listening.
There you go. Okay, so this dude, he became the first mayor of Tel Aviv, which was also, by the way, is the first Jewish-only city in modern times. First Jewish-only city.
And again, what year was this?
When he founded it, I think it was founded in the early 1900s. So this was long before the official establishment of Israel. They already founded.
And this was long before Nazi Germany and the quote, you know, the Jews need a protected place. So already, you know, even this is before they had the excuse of, you know, they're fleeing for safety. They needed a safe place, and this is the only safe place for Jews to live. But this is already happening, right? So I just want to point that out.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%, yeah. Man, 100%. And look, another thing that is left out of this is that the overwhelming majority of Jews, including German Jews, did not want to go to Palestine. It was totally illogical for them, okay? Totally illogical. Okay, but so that's Meir Dizenhof, right? Another guy is this guy, yeah, can you see? That's Pinhas Rutenberg, and I'm probably butchering his name. It's on another podcast where the guy had a good chuckle. He's a Palestinian. And he had a good chuckle by the way I said his name, probably because it sounded like penis. Pinhas Rutenberg, right? That's how it sounds. This dude was an actual assassin. He's recognized as being an assassin. He was implicated in the assassination of a guy by the name of Father George Capone. And you can see even in Wikipedia, it says he played an active role in two Russian revolutions in 1905 and 1917. This guy found the Palestine Electric Corporation, which is currently the Israel Electric Corporation. And he actually did this with funding, again, from Baron Edmund de Rothschild. So we see the Rothschilds hand again in all this. Very interesting, yeah. And he was also, he served as the president of the Jewish National Council. The Jewish National Council, for people who aren't familiar, this was the predecessor. So this actually served as the government before the official establishment of Israel. So they had their own little area, the yeshiv, the Jewish community, and he was the president. So this is a very influential figure, and he brought electricity to the region. This dude was directly implicated in an assassination. Okay, and he was also, he ran in these radical terrorist circles. And then another one, right? Yitzhak Ben Zvi. Yitzhak Ben Zvi was the second and longest standing president. He was also a radical Marxist. He worked very closely just quickly, can you see the tab that I've got it on you? Yitzhak Ben Zvi.
All I see is Meir Dizenhof.
Oh, man, Gavin, because I'm doing this incorrectly. Come on, Gavin. All right. My apologies, people. Okay, there's the dude, Pinhas Rutenberg, that I was talking about
there
now.
There he is.
Right. Okay, boom. Sorry about that, man. I'm jumping from tab to tab, but it doesn't actually follow me like that. I have to do it within this. Okay, so that's the guy. He was literally implicated in assassinating a guy by the name of Father Capone in Russia. As you can see, he played an active role in two Russian revolutions in 1905 and 1917. He also helped find, again, I was talking about the Jewish Legion. Remember, that was found with the help of Leo Amery, the guy from the Round Table movement, which we'll get back to that. Then Ben Zvi, Yitzhak Ben Zvi. So let me just look this dude up. There you go. All right, this guy, he was the second and longest serving president of Israel. He worked very closely with David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister. Mm-hmm. And he actually helped to find the first underground military organization. And from the get-go, this dude had outlined a plan on how they were going to take basically Israel through underground military kind of tactics. And what's really interesting about this dude as well is in 1924, he ordered the assassination. Okay, 1924, he ordered the assassination of another Jewish guy by the name of Jacob Israel Dahan. Okay, let me see if I can just look this up. Okay, there he is there. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, he was a Dutch
Jew. Too peaceful?
Well, he was basically, at first, he was interested in Zionism. He was interested in establishing a Jewish state. And then when he got there, he became disillusioned. And so he was an influential writer. And so he opposed the state of Israel, and they assassinated him. So assassination, targeted assassination, has been a long-standing policy of the Jewish establishment in Israel, the Zionist establishment specifically. Zionism was not a popular thing. That's what people just simply do not recognize. It was not a popular thing. And there's a book here that I just want to look up very quickly that people can go check out called, there you go, Rise and Kill First by Ronan Bergman. And it talks about the secret history of Israel's targeted assassinations. And he's like an establishment historian, but you can learn about some of the targeted assassinations. There's a very, very long history involved in all of that. And then finally, let's talk about this dude, Vladimir Zahev Jabotinsky.
Oh, there's the most guy, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's the most commemorated figure in Israel's history. So there are more streets, more buildings, more landmarks named after him. He also graced their money than any other figure in their history. And he also was instrumental in founding the Jewish Legion. And I didn't illuminate this, my apologies. The Jewish Legion fought for the British Empire during World War One. They were actually the force that came into Palestine and conquered Palestine. Okay? So there's a close relationship between the British Empire and the Zionist Jews from the very beginning. And this guy was the founder of something called Revisionist Zionism. Okay? You can see over there, he was a Revisionist Zionist leader. The reality is he wasn't just a leader. He was the founding father of Revisionist Zionism. Revisionist Zionism is, to keep it very simple, let's share this. Let's stop. Okay. Revisionist Zionism is this notion some people may have heard of, the Greater Israel Project, or the Zionist Project for the Middle East, something along those lines. What they had in mind was a very large tract of land. So he wasn't, none of these people were religious. Okay. Meir Dizenhof, I haven't been able to find any information on his proclivities in that regard, but David Ben-Gurion wasn't religious, Yitzhak Ben-Zvi wasn't religious, Jabotinsky wasn't religious. All of them, they scoffed at religion, okay?
Yeah.
They were very happy to quote the Torah and the Bible to justify their claims to Israel. And sure, one of the things they did was they said that the original kingdom of David, the kingdom of the 12 tribes of Israel, or the kingdom of Judah, more specifically, that's the land that they feel entitled to. And suppose, let me see if I can quickly bring up a map of that so people can see it, to get an image of what specifically that represents and encapsulates, because it's a massive swath of land. And when you see that, then you will understand why they are so fixated on expanding their borders. Okay, so while I pull
and
that
they
up,
saw an opportunity to use religions to galvanize people into
100%.
Following this course, even though they themselves could have cared less. In fact, many of them were very anti-religion. If they were, Marxist, was thoroughly through them. Marxism has no patience for religion at all. In many 100%. Ways, it does away with it,
Yeah, so 100%. So the way to understand and to contextualize the figures I just mentioned, specifically David Ben-Gurion and Vladimir Zahev Jabotinsky. David Ben-Gurion was like the father of the labor Zionist movement, which was the left wing. All right, so to keep it easier for people to digest, it's like the Democrats, but a really extreme version, extreme left wing. Mm-hmm. And then Vladimir Zahev Jabotinsky, he was the founder of Revisionist Zionism, which was the right wing, so Republicans, but an extreme right wing. So they're not comparable, but just so people can understand, there's a bit of a distinction there, right, within their minds. Now, both of them, although they certainly differed in how they were going to accomplish their goals, one thing they both agreed upon is they wanted an Arab minority. They wanted to displace the Arab majority with a Jewish majority. So immediately, that's very confrontational. That's very insidious. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a publication here, just to show people how far back this goes, entitled, can we get this to come up?
Let me just want to say this. So the Jews were the minority. Okay.
Overwhelming.
Oh, clearly, historically accurate. They were the minority, but their aspirations and plans were not to simply live in peace. That was not what their agenda was. They were not provoked they were living amongst Palestinians for a while, but their aspirations and their warlike tendencies, you know, quickly made them unpopular. As any Russian and China nationalists who moved to America and were the minority, but had openly declared that soon they would no longer be the minority and they would take the majority by force, they might make a few enemies. You know, they might 100%. Just rub people the wrong way.
Exactly.
So this is history. This is what actually fucking happened. You know,
yeah.
not this nonsense that you've been sold.
Exactly.
And
so
go ahead.
So first thing I just want to show people, to give people a view. This is something behind revisionist Zionism. This is what they wanted, okay? And this is what they still want. King David's empire. And as you can see, this goes way beyond what we recognize today as Israel. This goes, it goes into Egypt. It goes into Syria. It goes into the Jordan. And one of the ways in which this was articulated as early as 1923 in a publication entitled The Iron Wall. This was written by Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky. And just so people know, this was a very smart guy. He's recognized by academics and historians as being kind of like a Renaissance man. He spoke many, many languages. He was very well cultured. He was a clever guy. That is undeniable. Nobody can deny that. And what is actually what I admire a bit more about him than the modern day guys is he was very unambiguous, man. He spoke very plainly about what he had in mind. And he spoke about how they are going to have to colonize the region. And he said, look, of course they don't have it in here. Oh, no, there it is. Okay, fantastic. It is there. Okay, let me see if I can blow this up so you can read it. So can mm-hmm. you see, have I got it on the page where it says Iron War Essay?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So he wrote this in 1923, which is the first thing, right? And you can see he wrote the essay. And basically it's about having a Zionist settlement on the east bank of the Jordan River. And it was actually on both sides. No, this was Winston Churchill, excuse me, saying you can't have one on the east side of the Jordan River. To put that into context and perspective, that means you can't have a Jewish state also in Jordan, because that was what they wanted. Mm-hmm. They wanted to expand, like I said, to the borders of the Kingdom of David, which is massive.
Right.
Okay. And it's a point of contention about how historically accurate that is. Mm-hmm. Like I said, he wasn't religious, but he was more than happy. There was a very strong, and I suppose we'll get there. Sorry, I'm starting to jump all over the place here.
Okay.
So yeah, we can see a very significant quote from this. And this helps to contextualize the position. And this is why I said, at least he had the balls to spell out what he had in mind. He said, Zionist colonization must either stop or else proceed regardless of the native population, which means that it can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population behind an iron wall, which the native population cannot breach. And he goes on further to talk about how they need to have a strong military power. He's really considered the father of modern Jewish militancy. And he was a bit of a proponent of kind of the new Jew. He was this concept of the new Jew, all right? He was a disciple of a guy by the name of Max Nordau. So as you can imagine, there's always figures that are influenced by somebody before. Just as we are influenced by other people, so too is the same with him. And this leads us to something to understand Vladimir Jabotinsky and then revisionist Zionism and the ethos and how that has infiltrated or come to define the state of Israel. We can quickly just explore Max Nordau very quickly. We don't have to go too much into him, but Max Nordau, very prominent Zionist, he was actually one of Theodor Herzl's best friends and one of his advisors, and he came up with this idea of course, they don't have it up here, so now I'm going to have to probably look it up, or maybe it's somewhere in here. Oh, there you go, muscular Judaism. Okay, and this was a new concept. Yeah, some of the most anti-Semitic individuals of their time were themselves, in fact, Jews. So they would frown upon how Jews were conventionally. They said that they were weak, they had these office jobs, they needed to become strong, and they needed to create this new Jew. And that's what muscular Judaism was about. And Vladimir Zaev Jabotinsky was a big proponent of this, and so he vouched usually for militancy. And he was instrumental in the founding of something called the Batar Naval Academy, the Batar Youth Group. Very Nazi-like kind of thing. Let me stop sharing that. I can articulate this a bit because I'm getting too hung up on the slides. It's going to detract from me being able to just speak on this and inform people. So Mac's daughter was a very prominent figure, very influential behind the scenes. Like I said, he was an advisor to Theodor Herzl and one of his best friends. He was also actually asked to lead the World Zionist Organization, which was the government behind the government, behind the whole Jewish establishment movement, behind the whole Zionist movement. And he actually declined because he said, no, I'm married to a Christian woman, and it'll set a bad example.
Won't go over well, yeah.
Right. And Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky was profoundly influenced by this concept of a new Jew, a strong Jew. And so he started to really advocate strongly militancy. David Ben-Gurion was also influenced by this. Now, they came from different political sides, but David Ben-Gurion had the idea more so, having Marxist views that, and this is kind of also something that would manifest in Nazi Germany, that the land would redeem the people. So the Jewish people had to get dug into the economy. They had to have an exclusively Jewish economy, and this would redeem the new Jew. Now, another guy that is very significant, and we're going to get back in a moment, but this is when we get into eugenics. Okay, another guy that was profoundly influenced by Max Norder was a guy by the name of Arthur Rupin. Okay, Arthur Rupin. Let me pull him up real quick so people can see who I'm speaking about. And Arthur Rupin, boys and girls, was an actual eugenist. He was an unapologetic, outspoken eugenist. And he also worked with Nazi eugenists. He met with them. He, in fact, came from Nazi Germany. And this is where things start to make a bit more sense. Arthur Rupin, which is this dude over here, he was the first individual. He was in charge of an organization called the Palestine Office. And this Palestine Office was the predecessor to the Jewish Agency. The Jewish Agency was in control of land purchases, in control of immigration. And so he was the first guy that controlled who was going to immigrate to the state of Palestine. And his whole view of the world was that Ashkenazi Jews were superior to other Jews. So remember I said you get three distinct Jews, which is Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi is mostly European Jews, Western European Jews. Sephardic, which is from the Mediterranean area, so Italy, Portugal, North Africa. And then the Mizrahi Jews, which is from more Arab countries. He had the view that Ashkenazi Jews were superior. All right. And I'm sure I can probably pull up something in here. This is one of the good things, just to quickly help people. Yeah, I'll teach a course on this too, about how to do research. In Wikipedia, guys, although Wikipedia is undeniably full of shit, if you always go look at the sources, you can actually get some good information. So you see over here, I put in the search term eugenics. You press Control F, you can quickly do that. And then you go to Zionist eugenics, mixed marriage, and the creation of a new Jewish type. Now, I've also, of course, downloaded publications of Arthur Rupin specifically speaking on these things. But to make a long story short, he was a seminal figure and is actually recognized as the father of Zionist settlement. Now, there's a lot of different names and titles because Baron Edmund de Rothschild is recognized as the father of Palestinian colonization. But he's recognized as the father of Zionist settlement. And a lot of people don't know who Arthur Rupin is, but he was a major, major, major figure. Arthur Rupin was in charge, like I said, of settling the immigrants in the country. And he wanted only Ashkenazi Jews. All right. Only Ashkenazi Jews. I'm going to see if I can bring this up here very quickly. And if you look also at the earliest accounts of the immigrants that were coming in, and even to this day, the leadership of the state of Israel is made up overwhelmingly of Ashkenazi Jews. That's not to say that there's not overlapping, but it reflects his ideology, his view, yes, his view that he wanted only Ashkenazi Jews. And he was all about eugenics. In the middle of World War II, he met with one of the leading eugenists from Nazi Germany. For people to understand eugenics, it's not just about white supremacy. That's an oversimplification, because there were Indian eugenists, there were Japanese eugenists, there were Chinese eugenists. China's one child policy was about eugenics. It's essentially at the highest levels. It's about elitism, and there started to be a lot of diversity and people changing the interpretation of it. And of course, in Nazi Germany, they got the ideas from America, specifically a guy by the name of Madison Grant. And Madison Grant was funded overwhelmingly by the Rockefeller family.
Shocker.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let me go ahead. I'm going to share the screen here and we can check out some stuff here. Okay, so this is a publication called Jewish Eugenics from a guy, Professor John Glad. And this is page 188. And you see over here, architect of Jewish settlements in Palestine, Arthur Rupin writes in his diary, "I am becoming increasingly aware of the extent to which the Jews return to Eretz Israel and agriculture should be seen as a primary eugenic phenomenon." Okay.
Wow.
Primary eugenic phenomenon. Another quote from him, Arthur Rupin, who was also the head of the World Zionist Organization office in Palestine, writes in his book, 1930-1931, The Sociology of the Jews, that, and I quote, "In order to preserve the purity of our race, Jews displaying signs of genetic defects should not have children. He maintains that Ashkenazic Jews are not Semites and considers Oriental and Sephardic Jews, whose Semitism he recognizes as inferior." Rupin finds a book by a racial theoretician, who, if I'm not mistaken, became a Nazi, Hans Gunther, in a Tel Aviv bookstore, and comments in his diary, and I quote, "It brings on many thoughts that I had in mind for my own book." And then lastly, architect of Jewish settlements in Palestine, and these are all coming from John Glad's publication, Jewish Eugenics. You can go and look all of this up for free on archive.org, guys. You just create yourself an account. It's free to do so. Excellent, excellent resource to get a hold of academic publications without having to dish out all of the cash. And oftentimes these academic publications that have very incriminating information in them are extremely pricey. Like they can cost thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Noviad explains that architect of Jewish settlements in Palestine and eugenicist Arthur Rupin, in an article entitled, and I quote, "Selection of the Fittest," explains, and I quote, "It would naturally be desirable to have only racially pure Jews entering Palestine. But a direct influence on the process by selecting those immigrants who most closely approach this racial type is not a practical possibility. It would, of course, be preferable to have only strong and healthy persons come to settle in Palestine so that we would be assured a strong and healthy succeeding generation. Unfortunately, this greatly desired objective cannot be implemented with such generalized simplicity." Okay, so we can see over there, this guy is one of the founding fathers of Israel. He's never spoken about it, but he was a very strong proponent of eugenics. Like I said, I didn't have all the time to put together a meticulous slideshow. I have all the details that show he met with Nazi leaders, and also showing the immigration statistics where you see these very large numbers of Ashkenazi Jews coming on early in. And I'm going to teach, I'll do a masterclass online for that so people can check it out. But you can clearly see he has a very strong component of eugenics. And this guy was in charge of land purchases. He was in charge of the immigrants coming in. And he held that position for decades, in the very beginning. So there's another finding for this. So what we have is we have an ebb and flow where we've got on one side these radical Jews that are coming in. They comprise the founding fathers. And we'll get more into what they did and how they started to really engage in actual insane levels of terrorism, massacres, killing, indiscriminate killings, innocent people, children,
false flags. I mean, false flags. 120-year-old false flags where they're just setting up their own people to be slaughtered. They do this, you know.
Yeah, it's just crazy stuff, man. I mean, also, especially with labor Zionism. So the thing with revisionist Zionism and Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky, David Ben-Gurion used to call him actually Vladimir Hitler. And he had no problem calling Vladimir he called Vladimir Jabotinsky a Nazi. He called him, you know, it's just a weapon for propagandists. That's what people don't understand. The proverbial Gentile, what the rest of us don't understand, is propagandists, it doesn't matter their ethnicity, it doesn't matter their skin color, it doesn't matter their religion. No. They'll weaponize anything that is a hot topic. That's right. And so naturally he would weaponize us against other fellow Jews. Oh, you're Hitler. Right. Oh, you're a fascist and so on, because they didn't agree. But what's interesting about David Ben-Gurion and the labor Zionist movement is while Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky clearly on the surface was far more radical because he was frankly more unapologetic and himself, authentically himself, David Ben-Gurion was more cryptic and he was more underhanded. And later he revealed himself to be incredibly authoritarian and dictatorial. And of course, the two converged and they united later on for the purpose of authoritarianism and statism and terrorism. But, you know, long story short, let me also just go quickly to my file here on eugenics. There was an undeniable, let me just see this. He was in charge of something called the Palestine Land Development Company. You see, established in 1908. I'm sorry, I'm just going to read this because it's just too much to share screen and do this. It was established in 1908. Okay, so that's how early this dude was in operation. A German Jew as part of the World Zionist Organization, the Palestine Land Development Company, used Jewish National Fund and private monies. And by the way, he was also sponsored by Baron Edmund de Rothschild. He also received money. So he's always in the background, this dude. And at the same time, of course, what's he doing? He's funding the anti-Semitic regime of the Tsar Alexander III in Russia. Oh, how convenient. And of course, this extends to Nazi Germany later on. And so he was seminal in all of it. It explains that the PLDC, the Palestinian Land Development Company, bought nearly 90% of its land from large landowners, which we can get into that as well. And many of the transactions were controversial, right? They were underhanded and so on and so forth. So there was this very strong element of eugenics within the Jewish leadership, where they wanted to create something analogous. Well, they called it the New Jew, muscular Judaism, which is so important for people to understand, because you can't understand the modern state of Israel without recognizing what that is, without seeing you know what this is. And then as well, in addition to that, if we take a look at for example, in Israel there was a campaign to sterilize the Ethiopian immigrants. Some people may recall that. That right there is what eugenics is all about, guys. So for people who aren't familiar, it's about allowing the elite classes, the so-called elite classes, genetically to proliferate, to have babies, and then those who are considered to be inferior should not be allowed to have babies.
To be sterilized,
To be sterilized, right. Such as over Ethiopian woman in Israel given contraceptive without consent. Right, so we see this.
Danish programs all over the world adopted these ideologies and these sick movements. You know, I mean, and we're just starting to get a full grasp of the effects of them, because women, you know, I mean, this has been going on for decades.
Well, we have a population crisis now that, of course, nobody's speaking about, because they've got us all fixated on nuclear warfare, which is overwhelmingly theatrical. Because there's already a nuclear plan in place where, according to Professor Shauna Swan, a renowned epidemiologist who has been following and studying, and she's not controversial at all to cite, the sperm decline and the fertility crisis. Mm. She estimates by 2045 we won't be able to naturally procreate.
No.
So we'll that's what you
pay laboratory, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which nicely that naturally coincides. Yeah, and that coincides with transhumanism. And transhumanism is actually a term that was coined and popularized by a guy by the name of Professor Julian Huxley. And Julian Huxley was a member of the British Eugenics Society. He was actually the brother of Aldous Huxley. Mm-hmm. So when Aldous Huxley writes the books Brave New World, and what he's actually telling you is not so much coming from his imagination as coming from actual reality and being close to that movement and that establishment.
And what they want.
Yeah.
What their goals. 100%,
man. Okay, yeah, so man. Let me explain. Okay, so we kind of covered that. I'll provide a more in-depth look at everything when I do the masterclass. I'll come up with better slides. This has been so busy, man. It's a,
don't worry.
It's a full-time day, man. You know how that goes. But labor Zionism, we're going to now get into the connections with Zionist or with Nazi Germany. So first, let's establish. Okay, how do you want to contextualize this, Gavin? You're jumping all over the place. Let's go with how we slowly... Well, first, let me ask you, brother. Do you have any questions about anything in specific?
I mean, I'm always curious about...
Ask anything, man. It doesn't even have to be related specifically to what I mentioned, because there's all kinds of other things that I can provide some insight on.
You know, what boggles my mind is how, like... You know, I know there's literal, so oftentimes physical connections between Nazi Germany and the Zionist movement. I know that in actuality, Israeli government brought in Nazi higher military people to then
100% train the Mossad.
Them.
Yeah, the Mossad used a guy by the name of Otto Skorzeny, who was one of Hitler's right-hand men. He's one of his favorite spies. And this guy actually saved Mussolini. Go look him up. Otto Skorzeny, And he was brought into the Mossad, and he worked for the Mossad, Just like Operation Paperclip in the U.S., man. Same shit.
Yeah, but, and so, you know, you have this notion that Israel was started as a safe haven from further Nazi prosecution, and that they needed this... and yet at the same time, they're welcoming into their ranks, you know, these literally people who have the death of thousands and thousands and thousands, millions of Jewish people on their hands. And so, like, you start to see how, what a dark and twisted web this is that has been created by these so-called Jewish, you know, banking elites, particularly the Rothschilds, who, you know, had their hands in each and every part of this, positioning it for their own reasons, which is control and to further their wealth, you know. And so people don't understand. People think this is biblical. It ain't fucking biblical. It's fucking
not at all.
It's corporate, okay?
Yeah, you know, not at all. They've used the thing. Really, is they've used the biblical narrative as any parasite or predator does. I mean, the proverb, it's ancient, is all you need to know. It personifies exactly what this is all about, which is the proverbial wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah,
and what the way the agent of deception operates, which is why I specifically want to teach a course on this notion that extends beyond the trappings of tribalism and ideology and religion and so on, is that they will wear any mask of authority that you will blindly and unthinkingly obey. So if you are religious, they're going to wear religious clothing. This is why oftentimes what you will find is you will find predators, specifically pedophiles, in positions where they are entrusted to take care of children. Right.
Yeah.
It's not that there's specifically a problem in the Catholic Church or boys and girls clubs or, you know, so on and so forth. It's that the predator is a predator first and foremost, and it will wear whatever thing you least suspect so it can gain access to its victims. That's how it has traditionally operated, and that is how it will operate forever. Because the way that truth operates is it requires investigation. It requires being questioned. You know why? Because when you question or investigate, for example, I like to be questioned. Why? Because that's how I can prove my points. Truth wants to be questioned because that's how its power and authority is established.
Exactly.
Whereas deception relies on blind obedience. Oh, no, don't research.
Censorship.
Don't investigate.
Yeah.
Exactly. Don't question. Just believe. And, you know, the vehicle of Israel has, in that way, served this movement, which converges with it proceeds. You know, Nazism is also an offshoot, a later offshoot. This is just elitism. That's what it is. It's the elitist ideology, which even precedes the notion of religion, even our recognition of races as we see them today, because those are constructs in their own right. Like, this is a very long human story that people takes a lot of legwork, unfortunately. And another way in which it's personified, aside from the fact that they recruited high-ranking Nazis, is in Argentina, when Argentina had a dictatorship in which they also had Nazis that were funneled through the rat lines by the Central Intelligence Agency. And these Nazis went to go work. Yeah, well, I mean, people like Adolf Eichmann, for example. Adolf Eichmann, they basically, you can go look this up, even on the BBC, where Royal Dutch Airport Transportation Company, which at that time was controlled by Prince Bernard of the Netherlands. Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, who was a former SS official. He was a former Nazi, okay?
Yeah.
He was in control of this airline, and this airline helped Nazis escape. And one of the places they helped them escape to was Argentina. And anyways, during this dictatorship, they were committing these horrible atrocities, including against the local Jewish community. And guess who was arming and funding them and providing training? The State of Israel. The State of Israel. Yeah, no joke, brother.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
It's all bullshit, man.
It's all bullshit, and people don't understand that. People don't see the big picture. They don't understand the fact that the Jews that were killed in World War II were sacrificed at the altar of 100%. Fucking Zionism.
100%. And you know what? We can even get into it.
By the Rothschilds, you know? I mean, this is what they
needed.
Even
the Rothschilds, man. So you know David Ben-Gurion, right? He's recognized as the father of the primary father of the State of Israel. And for a long time, he was like kind of their golden child in terms of public relations and advertising. They try to avoid more revisionist Zionism, because within revisionist Zionism, there was the Irgun, which we can get into in a bit. The Irgun was a literal terrorist organization, carried out horrible massacres, King David Hotel bombing, did crazy, crazy shit.
But we talked about them in the last podcast too, yeah.
Yeah, David, well, I've learned so much more, man, wild shit. But David Ben-Gurion, he was actually so obsessed with the creation of the Jewish state that he thwarted the efforts of rescuing Jews from Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Him and Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann was the first president of Israel. So if you look at the Evian Conference, and you can actually find this information on Wikipedia. Let me go look it up quickly. It's because it's easy for me to... I can probably find it also in my in all my slides and stuff. But man, unfortunately, I'm not fully prepared for it.
But tell everyone what they did, because this is fucking important. This is what people don't want to believe, and they have a hard time understanding. You know, the fact that they did not want that they needed to bolster the body count. This is what they do.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Let me just okay. So while I'm looking for this, I can articulate it. Let's see if you can multitask here, Gavin. Essentially, if you go look up the Evian Conference, this was a conference that was set up in 1938. And it was set up by multiple governments, including the United States, to address what they clearly saw as these programs against Jews, and specifically in Germany. Like, okay, what are we going to do? Yeah. And one of the primary results of this was that it was massively unproductive, because the powers that be did not want to take in these Jewish immigrants. Now, of course, we know about this now, and it's framed as, oh, just, you know, the American government in Europe were just being totally heartless and so on. But what has been overlooked in this is the fact that Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel, and David Ben-Gurion, who at that time were working for the Jewish agency, they were literally lobbying. They were dissuading all the governments from taking in Jews. They only wanted Jews to go to Palestine. That was their thing.
There's or back to Germany to get killed.
Well, exactly. That's a no, really. That is it right there, man. And let me see. I want to show people that you can even see this shit now today. Excuse me, on Wikipedia. Okay, so you see over here. Okay, let me just get rid of that there. Zionist leaders Chaim Weizmann and Dave Ben-Gurion of the Jewish Agency were both firmly opposed to Jews being allowed entry into Western countries, hoping that the pressure of hundreds of thousands of refugees having nowhere to go would force Britain to open Palestine to Jewish immigration, which that's another story, right, which we can get into. I suppose let me quickly articulate that. touch on that and not go into it. But there you can clearly see they were opposed, guys. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind that there's a Holocaust that's precipitating here.
Right. This is literally during the Holocaust.
Well, no. This wasn't in the actual Holocaust. This was when the pogroms were going on and people realized. So it was recognized that there's serious Jewish persecution going on. And that it was the beginning stages. It was taking place, but people didn't know about it. Okay. On a major scale. Another thing is the Jewish agency, when they did become aware of the Holocaust, they waited for months before they shared the information publicly.
You know, they needed the body count. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things with the British restricting immigration is that for decades, they had been promising the Arab and Palestinians that they would curtail immigration because there were lots of underhanded maneuverings taking place. There were illegal immigrants coming in, and the Palestinians slowly began to realize and recognize what we spoke about earlier, where there was this methodical policy that they were going to get rid of the Arab majority, displace them, basically kick them out of the country and replace them one way or another, which we see going on today. This is a continued action. It's a continued ideology. That's why today what's going on is literally genocide, where they wanted to displace the majority population with the Jewish population. And so they required that there's going to be some kind of restriction on Jewish immigration. Now, that didn't mean that it was going to stop entirely, but they wanted it to be restricted because it was exploding. And with it exploding, another big thing that people don't talk about is that there was also large weapons caches in 1935, which preceded the something known as the Arab Revolt between 1936 and 1939, major event. But what preceded that, one of the major events, is something called the Cement Incident. The Cement Incident is when they found a massive illegal weapons cache of British-made machine guns. These were guns being used in war that were being smuggled into the country. And this freaked out the Palestinians big time because they said, okay, well, they're already trying to oust us. And now they've got all of these guns coming in and they're manufacturing grenades. Like, this is a bit of a problem, right? So that's why the immigration was being restricted on that level. It wasn't being completely throttled. But in recognition of this, now let's say you're in a position, you're a Jewish person, you know that these persecutions are taking place. Don't you want to just save Jews? Right? Don't you want to encourage the European governments and the U.S. governments?
Don't you want to rescue the hostages? How is carpet bombing achieving that? Oh, it's not. That's right. That's right.
100%,
it's not.
Man.
If you say that the Palestinians are using the Jews as body armor or whatever, then why are you carpet bombing thousands of Palestinians? Make it make sense, because none of the propaganda you've been sold is logical anyway. That's all I'm saying to people who are continuing this fucking idiocy, that like parroting the fucking rhetoric they've been fed by the legacy media and by Israeli propaganda machines. It's just absurd. Sorry, I had to get that.
No, 100%, brother. you need to let it loose, man. You got to let the...
It's
all of us, all of us, you know, on some level, we need to be informed, obviously, but we need to go ahead and speak out because, and we must try to do so with temperament, but we need to speak out because when we don't, we acquiesce to these hateful fucking people who aren't informed and they're unapologetically and loudly ignorant. And that's problematic, man. But what I just want to quickly share with you is this quote, man, this shocking, shocking quote from David Ben-Gurion that also helps to encapsulate his view. And this is from a book entitled, was recently published, called A State at Any Cost, which is exactly what it was all about, specifically for David Ben-Gurion. A State at Any Cost. Okay. Okay, so let me go over here. All right, there you go.
DB.
Yeah. There you go, David Ben-Gurion. And he had this infamous quote, and this is a credentialed historian. This is not a controversial quote. You can go look it up for yourself, guys, to get the context. But he says, and I quote, if I knew that it, because this, so basically to give the proper context, England had engaged in an operation where it saved thousands of children from Germany. Okay. Public pressure demanded that they go ahead and they save some children. They did so. They saved thousands of kids, some Jewish kids from Germany. And then David Ben-Gurion went in and said this in response. If I knew that it was possible to save all the children in Germany by transporting them to England, but only half by transporting them to Palestine, I would choose the second. because we face not only the reckoning of these children, but the historical reckoning of the Jewish people. Now, if you are willing to say that publicly, what are you saying privately?
My God.
That's insane. So you are willing to sacrifice half of those kids just so you can find the state of Israel, right?
That just goes to show you where they were at mentally and what the lengths they're willing to go to. They're willing to kill their own.
Yeah, no, 100%, man. So here's another example of that. This is A State at Any Cost again, page 279, I think. Can't really read how I cited this. But again, people can put these search terms in archive.org and it'll come up. And what he basically talks about, this was after the British started to restrict immigration, right? He basically had in mind that he would land a massive amount of illegal Jewish immigrants in Palestine. And if they were shot at by the British soldiers, that would serve his purpose, because there would be terrible public relations for the British Empire.
Yeah.
So he was very calculated, a very calculated politician.
Yeah, they wanted the British Empire out, so they were willing to false flag to do that.
Yeah, well, you see, there's a whole other dimension to that, man. This is when the Roundtable Group also comes in, because they were still working with him. Okay, so let's touch on that quickly to provide a bit of clarity. And also just one more thing, actually, before we move forward. The transfer agreement, the Havara agreement, right? Let's go ahead and let's touch on this, because this is such a significant piece of history, man, that also has not been shared appropriately and correctly with us. Oh, not that button. So the Havara agreement, which is sometimes called the transfer agreement, this was in 1933. This was when Hitler was in power. Can you see that? The Havara agreement. Okay, fantastic. So this was in 1933, right? And there was a massive worldwide boycott of German products taking place, okay? Massive boycott of German products taking place. This had a crushing effect on them economically. They couldn't contend with it. One of the most notable things historically that has worked against the ruling class, whether you look at the cessation of the plebs in ancient Roman history, which was like in the 4th century BC, or more recently with the truckers protesting against the vaccine mandates, is civil disobedience, when we just collectively say no. So with Nazi Germany, when they were faced with this boycott of their goods, they were in economic shambles.
Right.
Well, then they went ahead and they did a deal with the Zionist leadership, the predecessors to Israel. And just to be very clear, because the way this gets framed is that they did this to save Jews from Germany, right? The reality is that this was more so for elitist Jews, because what it was about was transferring their wealth from Germany. It was about transferring the goods. It wasn't about getting the Jews to Palestine.
No.
Hitler himself actually said that he would send the Jewish people off first class. That's how bad he wanted to get rid of the Jews. And look, there's this other side of the story where Hitler's this hero. Hitler was not a hero. That's also ridiculous bullshit, man.
It's propaganda. Totally.
Exactly. It's no different than pick the left or pick the right. We're giving you two options.
That's right.
Nothing exists beyond that. Don't think. Don't use your imagination. Don't look internally. Look externally for answers. And so that's what he said. He was willing to pay to get rid of the Jewish class.
Yeah.
So this way, the Havara Agreement, in spite of what is popularized and the linguistic gymnastics they engage in to make it seem this was about getting the assets of wealthy Jews out of Germany. And so what they did in order to facilitate this agreement is they got rid of the Jewish boycott against Nazi Germany. So guess what? Nazi Germany could have probably ended right then and there. But the Zionist leadership, again, with their virulent fixation on the creation of a state in Palestine.
They knew they needed it. They knew that what they were going to need to do that.
Yeah, which was highly unpopular, man. Again, most Jews had no interest in immigrating to Palestine, which is further personified later on in the early 1950s through actual terrorist attacks in Middle Eastern countries to encourage massive immigration into Israel. And the Mizrahi Jews that arrived there, if you look at Professor A.V. Schlaim and his account, because he was one of them, how they were sprayed him with DDT. They treated him like shit. There was racism to Jewish, Jewish people being racist towards Jewish people. I mean, story of the humans, man. Humans are a funny, funny breed sometimes.
So
that encapsulates some of the Nazi relations. And on Vladimir Zhev, Jabotinsky, and the revisionist Zionist side, they thought it was reprehensible to work with Nazi Germany. However, Vladimir Zhev Jabotinsky had no problem working with Mussolini. In fact, he founded a naval academy. Let me go look this up real quick. The Bator Naval, Bator Naval Academy. So the Bator Naval Academy, right, was basically a predecessor to Israel's Navy. So a lot of people from Israel's Navy went to the Bator Naval Academy. Let me see. All right, let's go ahead and share that quickly. What time is it where you are, cousin? I don't want to keep you up late, man. What time is it?
It's almost midnight.
Look, we can break this up into a second one if you want to do that.
Yeah, man. We might have to.
Jeez, I had no idea we're so late by you,
don't
man.
Don't worry about it, brother. It's it wouldn't even be that bad. I've been going nonstop all day.
We'll have to break it up.
Yeah,
we'll have like to. And we've been going on for almost, over 2.5 hours. My goodness.
Yeah, it's fucking time flies, man. There's just so much information to go through and so much to lay out. But listen, let's plan to pick it up and we'll just do another two-part because, I mean, we got to go through. We went through a lot, but we could still, let's still make our way up into.
It's a nice way to start off the next one with Nazi Germany.
We'll pick back up with the Zionist-Nazi relationship. I'm wishing you well, brother, health and happiness to you and your family. And I'm here if you need to let me know what I can do to help.
You've been amazing, man.
Whatever it is, bro. I'm happy to help because you're doing really important work. And I want to see it get out more. You know, I want to see it reach more people because people need to be. People need the knowledge, you know. Ignorance is part of the veil that this, you know, that's keeping us from evolution. So I'm all for it. But hey, I appreciate your time, man. I appreciate your work so much, and man, I love you, bro.
Love you too, man.
Good luck with everything, and you know, I'm gonna catch some Z's, but we're gonna reconnect.
Get some fucking sleep, man. I had no idea it was so late. I'm sorry about that, man. Fuck.
No, it's not your fault, bro. No, this nice schedule is look. But we're on opposite sides of the planet. We're like 12 hours apart, so we had to do it when we could do it. So I'm glad we got into it.
It's just 12 hours, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, man, bro. Look, you get some sleep, brother, and we'll chat again soon, man.
All right. Okay, bro. Thank you, Gavin.
All right. Thanks, brother. Okay, cool, man.